They're known as some of the original recyclers. The National Tractor Parts Dealer Association is a sponsor of the Business News Hour. With members in the United States, Canada, Great Britain, Australia, and New Zealand, delivering ag parts to farmers and ranchers. NTPDA.com.
Welcome back to Inside on Business, the News Hour. Grateful that you have clicked through again today. This is a special edition because I promised you that we would have George Isaacson back with us. George is a constitutional law professor in Maine. He has recently spoken to the National Tractor Parts Dealer Association in Maricopa, Arizona, on the issue of taxation and internet sales. So if you are at all involved in not just the purchasing of stuff online, but if you're involved in the selling of stuff online, this is going to all impact you. George, a pleasure to see you in person, my friend. How are you?
It's great to be back with you again, Michael.
Great to be here. We've had now several conversations offline about this, and I just find your ability to distill all of these various issues that come with online sales to be absolutely fascinating. So I thank you for your time in advance. Let's talk a little bit about you, first of all, to refresh individuals' memories. You are from Maine. You have a family up there, and you've been in the law profession for some time, but you have a special niche. What is that?
Well, it's been interesting. I've been able to develop both a legal practice and an academic interest involving the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which goes back to 1787. And the problems that the country was facing at that time. And I've been fortunate to be able to not only develop a legal practice in that area, but also a teaching profession as well.
And you're at your alma mater.
I am, which is great fun that I'm teaching at Bowdoin College, where I went as an undergraduate. Went out of state to law school at the University of Pennsylvania, came back to Maine, and Bowdoin asked me to start teaching in this field the year that I came back.
Nice. And tell us just a brief story about Bowdoin.
Well, Bowdoin's a really interesting school. It was established back when Maine was part of Massachusetts.
Really?
And in fact, the Bowdoin Charter was established by the Massachusetts legislature. And when Bowdoin has its charter amended, you need to go back to Massachusetts. Some great alumni. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow went to Bowdoin. Nathaniel Hawthorne went to Bowdoin.
Wow.
President Franklin Pierce went to Bowdoin. So it has a great tradition. But I think for your listeners who haven't been to Maine or haven't visited Bowdoin, the image that they would have is of the classic New England college that's located on the coast of Maine in a charming city with only 1,800 students. It's a very intimate environment, a great place for learning, a great place for teaching.
And you told me off mic that you have your office in your home.
So we live on a residential street that cuts through the college campus, and because I have my office hours in my home, we oftentimes sit in front of the fireplace, and students, instead of requesting office hours, will ask for a fireside chat.
Of course. This is Americana, right, in our own mind. Let's come back to the Constitution. You just mentioned the Constitution and the issues that we had all these 13 colonies and they became states, and there was a real reason for those individuals to come together to put together some kind of a code to live by. What was the real driving factor that you believe was the reason for the Constitution?
So one of the things that I think is interesting, Michael, is that when people today think about the Constitution, they oftentimes think about freedom of religion and freedom of the press and other elements of the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights were all amendments to the Constitution. They weren't the reason for the original convention in Philadelphia in 1787. And the reason for that convention was that these newly independent states that really considered themselves to be independent nations were erecting trade barriers between each other in order to protect their domestic industries. High taxes, tariffs, duties, and the effect was to throw the country into a depression. And so the reason that the Constitutional Convention was called was to figure out a way that the economy could be revitalized by eliminating these trade barriers. And the result was to create a free trade area, a customs union, really 200 years before the Europeans had the idea to do so with the European Common Market. The result of that was tremendously successful. and created the greatest engine of economic and social mobility in the history of mankind, the American economy.
And what had been previous, Virginia and North Carolina or Massachusetts or Maryland, would have their own laws, rules, and regulations with regard to trade.
Absolutely.
And so this and the Commerce Clause then said, oh, no, we're all going to be on the same playing field.
That was the vision that was created. And to a large extent, it's been successful. What's been disturbing is when you see the re-erection of trade barriers among the states. And I've been especially interested and involved in the field of state taxation, because what's really developed in the area of state taxation is a crazy quilt of laws that are in fact an impediment to the growth of business and free trade.
You argued before the United States Supreme Court, and this was quite the decision that the court handed down. Can you go through that for just a bit?
So there are really two cases that I argued before the Supreme Court. One in 2015, a case called Direct Marketing Association versus Broll, which also dealt with the tax issue, and which the Direct Marketing Association, my client, won 9-0. But Justice Kennedy, in a concurring opinion, said he thought we should re-examine an issue that relates to whether a company has to have a physical presence in the state in order to be obligated to collect state taxes, state sales taxes. So it wasn't the issue in that case, but it was an invitation to have that issue in a future case. And that did come up in a 2018 case called South Dakota versus Wayfair. And in that case, what the court, in a very close 5-4 decision with a very strong dissent by the Chief Justice, concluded that the physical presence standard should no longer be applicable in this electronic age, and that instead, if a company exceeded a sales threshold to consumers in a state, that would be sufficient to then allow the state to impose tax obligations on the remote seller. And that's the issue that I was talking today at this conference.
And for those of you who are listening and you're thinking, well, wait a minute, what does this have to do with anything? Well, it has to do with that. If you're a buyer, perhaps, you know, you don't think about these kinds of things because these are things that are automatically or should be automatically taken care of. But if you are a seller, and how many sellers are there that are listening to this? If you're a seller of anything on internet, in internet commerce, this is going to pertain to you. So listen up, because I think this is all going to be somewhat a regurgitation of what we've talked about before, but this is now a face-to-face conversation that I get to have with George Isaacson, and I'm relishing that. George, so now, after the Wayfair decision, you don't have to necessarily have that physical presence in a state to be required to collect taxes, and because of economic commerce, you got to collect taxes all over. Would that be accurate if you meet a threshold?
That's correct. So in South Dakota, the legislation that the court upheld said if you have $100,000 of sales into the state or 200 transactions, either one, that would then subject you to the state's tax jurisdiction. And most states have now adopted that same standard. There are some variations. A couple of states have had $500,000 sales thresholds. But most states now have this economic threshold that says if you have no involvement with the state, are not in any way benefiting from any services provided to you by the state, you nonetheless have to collect their taxes. And it also has serious income tax implications, because increasingly a number of states are taking the position that the same economic presence standard should apply to obligations to file and pay state corporate net income taxes.
And that could be huge.
Be enormous.
Yeah. How many tax entities are there out there?
So this is one of the really alarming and disturbing features. There are over 12,000 different sales and use tax jurisdictions in the United States. Not only state taxes, not only municipal taxes, but county taxes, library district taxes, police district taxes, art cultural district taxes, transportation district taxes, sports stadium district taxes. And these districts overlap each other, and they are not concentric with zip codes. And so it is a very difficult system for figuring out which taxes apply, even within a given zip code. One of the examples I used today in the presentation to this conference was a zip code in Colorado that has five different tax rates.
In one zip code?
Correct.
All right. So if I am selling something, whatever that happens to be, outside of services, I believe it is, but if I'm selling physical stuff, and if I don't collect the taxes, so let's say that my business is in Iowa, for example, and I'm selling stuff in Maine, and I'm not collecting the taxes that are due, how do I ever know that I should have, A, been collecting those taxes, and B, what happens if I don't, and Maine finds out that I'm selling stuff up there?
So two things, and first a prefacing comment, that increasingly states are taxing services. And so it's not just an exposure for products that you sell, but for services that you sell also. And sales tax on services is very confusing because it can be unclear where the service is being provided. Mm. You may provide a service to a company that is being downloaded in multiple locations. And then you have the question of which state or tax jurisdiction has the right to tax that service. But going to the core of your question, the state takes the position that you're obligated to know what their tax laws are. Now, that wasn't difficult when you were located in a given state. That's where your employees were. That's where your accountant is. And if your business was in Maine, you had to know what the Maine tax laws are. To say that you now have to know what the tax laws are for 46 different states that have sales and use taxes and thousands of sub-political jurisdictions that have taxes is really a tremendously difficult task. The second part of your question is, what happens if you don't do it correctly? States have audit departments, and they will come out and they will audit you. And increasingly, small and medium-sized companies are being audited, not just the large companies. If you didn't collect the tax that is on their books, then you will be issued an assessment, because any company that has an obligation to collect tax and fails to do so is itself liable for that tax. The state will then reduce that to a judgment against the company if they don't comply with the assessment, if they don't pay the assessment. And they can take that judgment under what's called the Full Faith and Credit Clause of the U.S. Constitution, in which a judgment rendered in any state can be enforced in any sister state. So
you got it.
You got it.
Yeah. So you're on the line. There was another interesting thing that you told these folks today, that to actually get a hearing and actually fight this, or at least appear in the jurisdiction where you're being taxed, say, back in Maine again, and you're an Iowa business, you got to go there.
That's absolutely right. And if we go back to what the situation was before, it wasn't especially unfair. If you were a Maine company and you received an assessment and you thought it was wrong and you wanted to appeal it, you'd find out where the state capital is, which happens to be in Augusta, not too far away, and you'd go through the appeal process. So now, under this new economic presence standard, if you get an assessment from the state of Washington, you've got to look on a map and find out where Olympia is. You've got to go out to Olympia. You have to retain an attorney, and you have to go through first the administrative appeal process and then through the court process. For many companies, and especially for smaller companies, it is just not economically feasible to challenge these assessments. So you end up waiving effectively your rights and just paying the tax anyway.
Can sometimes these tax charges back to whatever company is doing the sales, some people work on a pretty skinny margin. What happens then? Can you go back to the people that you've sold stuff to and say, oh, by the way, you now owe us X amount of dollars in taxes?
You know, and it's worse than that. Obviously, going back to a customer and saying, I didn't collect the tax from you, will you pay it now?
You're right.
It's not the way to build a business. But another feature, and it was raised by one of the people who attended the conference today, and she was pointing out that the administrative cost for collecting taxes in many of these jurisdictions is greater than the actual amount of tax that is collected. Now, what kind of a system is efficient where the cost of administering the system is greater than the revenue which you obtain? And that's what is now being imposed. The cost of integrating software, the cost of hiring new accounting personnel, is greater than the actual taxes collected and remitted back to the state.
George Isaacson is our guest. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about online sales and taxes. If you are selling stuff online, this pertains to you. All right, well, we've laid out a pretty problematic scenario here. And this is 12,000 tax entities. Some things are taxed, some things are exempt. Agriculture is sometimes exempt, and then the definition of who's a farmer and who's not a farmer. And we got all this mishigas out there trying to figure out who's liable for this. What do we do?
So what's really needed is a system that simplifies taxes. And that's an easy bandwagon to get on board. The question is often raised, is it possible to simplify taxes? And it absolutely is. And let me give you an example that I think is very relevant to this discussion. For a long time, interstate trucking companies had the burden of having to file fuel taxes with each individual state, which was terribly cumbersome and administratively expensive. What the federal government did was to negotiate and adopt what's called the International Fuel Tax Agreement. And it's called international because Canadian provinces participate. Now what trucking companies do is file a single Excel spreadsheet form, which indicates what their mileage is going through each state, write a single check, submit it to a clearinghouse, and the clearinghouse distributes it to the states. In the sales and use tax area, we could easily have uniform definitions, common remittance forms, a similar clearinghouse. We don't need the kind of complexity and lack of uniformity which has created the crazy quilt of taxation that we have at the state level now. What we need is for Congress, after it gets through with things that are making it immobile right now, to pay attention to this issue and to adopt such simplification. There are good models that are out there. They need to be adopted, and they need to be endorsed by Congress.
If I am selling something for wholesale, do I also pay a tax on that?
So if you're selling it wholesale, you do not pay the tax or collect the tax because it's a sale for resale. But one of the complexities are that each state has its own system for requiring resale certificates. Tremendously difficult to administer. There's absolutely no reason there shouldn't be a single uniform resale exemption certificate, a farm machinery exemption certificate, a charitable purchaser exemption certificate. Easy to do. What it just takes is the states coming together to achieve that objective.
What are the states, what's their motivation to even look at this?
Well, I'd like to think that good government is a motivation.
Come on, George.
Maybe I'm naive. I think the motivation is that if you can make tax administration more simple, that what you're going to get is a greater level of compliance, fewer mistakes, and I think it will be to the benefit of the states. 24 states have entered into what's called the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement that does achieve a number of simplification measures. The problem is they're primarily the smaller states, and it represents less than 30% of the nation's population. So the large states like California, New York, Florida, Texas, Pennsylvania are not members of that. Congress should say, if you want to export your tax system beyond your state borders, you have to simplify, and the method for simplification would be participating in this streamlined agreement.
And to move this forward, what do you think needs to happen? In each individual state, do people need to start having this conversation? And it sounds like a win-win. If I'm a manufacturing association, or if I'm a retail trade association, or whatever I happen to be, this would seem to be okay. I could have this conversation.
You're absolutely right. And I think what the limitation has been to date is that this has not been on the top of the agenda. And there's a lot of impact if you get four, five, six businesses who walk into a congressman's office together and say, we're not against taxes, but we're in favor of tax simplification. There are pending bills in Congress that would achieve that objective. We would like you to become a sponsor. That's not a big ask. And what's really necessary right now is to get some real attention on this issue, to get co-sponsorship of some of the more some of the proposals that would really make a change. And when Congress gets past its current problems, I think this is an issue that could get real traction.
It certainly could. His name is George Isaacson, ladies and gentlemen. We will have links up to his website on the radio blog. George, I cannot thank you enough for taking this 18 minutes out of your schedule. I know you got all kinds of things to do. But I find, again, and I think I overuse this word constantly, I just find this fascinating that we aren't talking about this more and more, because to the general consumer, it doesn't matter. But if you're selling stuff, it matters greatly.
Well, I'm so glad you're bringing it to your listeners' attention, because I think it's an issue that is a win-win. I truly believe that it's a win for the national economy. It's a win for the states if they can administer their systems of taxation with greater efficiency. And it's certainly a win for businesses that would be relieved from many of the burdens that right now are not only complex but make no economic sense.
George Isaacson, thank you so very much. I appreciate this. Once again, that was George Isaacson. We will have links to his law firm out of Maine up on our radio blog. Well, that ends it for another broadcast day. Thanks so very much for being with us. For all of us to put this together each and every day, Chap Ramsey is our production coordinator. Aaron Libby's in charge of sales and marketing. Hunter Pease is the voice of the Business News Hour. And the music you're listening to right now is arranged, composed, and conducted by our friend James Goodlett from Jam Good Productions. For all those folks and for George Isaacson, my name is Michael Libby. Have yourself a wonderful day. Be safe, be well, be careful, most of all, be good to your fellow man. Good day.